Secretary Azar declared a public health emergency, which is not the same thing as a national emergency, on January 31st. And for legal purposes, what that did was that triggered a small number of public health statutes and a small number of sort of bureaucratic and administrative softening of rules that would have allowed the government, among other things, to ratchet up, for example, experimental drug approval through the FDA, to reallocate at least certain funding resources. It would have allowed the government, I think, on a plausible reading of the statute, to dramatically ramp up the production of tests for the coronavirus. And so the secretary's declaration of a public health emergency actually triggered a bunch of powers that the executive branch, at least so far as we know, Ben, did not aggressively utilize, at least at first.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 19th, 2020. It is a bonus edition. Last night, I got on the phone with Steve Vladek, who needs no introduction for Lawfare listeners, to talk about presidential emergency powers, all things presidential emergency powers. What can the president do? What limits what the president can do? What authorizes the president to do all those things he can do in a national emergency? Is the president abusing, misusing, using appropriately, or underusing emergency powers in the coronavirus crisis? And what are the logical endpoints, how far this could go? It's a wide-ranging conversation, a lot of hypotheticals, a lot of scenarios, a fair bit of speculation, and a whole lot of law. It's the Lawfare Podcast bonus edition, Steve Vladek on emergency powers and coronavirus. All right, I want to start with federalism, because we have a federal response that people are seeing, or a federal non-response, depending on your perspective. And you also have all these coercive measures that are being taken at the state and sometimes municipal levels. So which part of the response, broadly speaking, is federal, and which part is state and local?
I mean, I think that's going to vary a lot by what day it is that we're talking about and by what jurisdiction we're talking about. Historically, we've left most of the responsibility, for lack of a better term, to state and local authorities for a couple of different reasons. One, because they're actually there on the ground, and at least some of these public health crises historically have been geographically confined. Two, because unlike the federal government, state and local governments have a police power. That is to say, you know, they have general regulatory authority over their populace, including health and safety codes. And then three, just as a matter of pure national politics, that, you know, inertia has often favored leaving as much of the response as possible to state and local governments, just because, you know, maybe there are budgetary objections at the federal level, maybe there really are pure federalism concerns, or maybe there are just, you know, not in my backyard objections. But, you know, it's rare to have a public health crisis with a national response, because it's rare in this country to have a national public health crisis.
Right. So my impression is that very little of the law on this subject actually tests the limits of the federal power. If you know, the famous quarantine cases, except insofar as they involve people arriving in the country, but the isolation cases they're all state cases. So if Donald Trump, let's start with, a sane, rational, reasonable version of Donald Trump with Anthony Fauci holding his hand and whispering in his ear, decided to impose what these counties in California imposed, you know, a sort of national lockdown. My impression is that that would be beyond the federal government's constitutional authority. Do we have any solid law on the question of how far the federal government can go in responding to a public health emergency?
The short answer to that is no. There's stunningly little law, partly because, again, you know, so much of the response historically has been handled in the first instance by state and local governments. But also, I think it's worth stressing so much, even when we've had federal responses, and we saw a little bit of that with SARS, we saw a little bit of that with H1N1, we saw it with a couple of isolated cases, a nurse in Maine from the Ebola crisis, Casey Hickox, a lawyer in Georgia with what we thought was extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis. The case law just hasn't fleshed out in any useful way just how far the federal government can go. I think it's a working assumption that the federal government lacks the power under any of its enumerated authorities. And again, we should be clear, we're mostly talking about Congress's powers here, that Congress lacks the power to reach all the way down to the quarantining you in your house level of disaster control and public health crisis management. But, you know, we have no case law to point to that other than sort of general cases about the limits of Congress's Commerce Clause power. And it's not hard to imagine the federal courts in general and this Supreme Court in particular being remarkably deferential to the federal government in a public health crisis like this one.
It's true, although it's also, you know, not hard to imagine the majority, it's not the same group of justices, but it's a similar flavor who, you know, resisted the idea that the Commerce Clause has no limits. And in the Gun-Free School Zones Act Lopez case and the Morrison case, really insisted, and the theory of it was that, you know, or part of the theory was, well, you couldn't have a general federal murder statute because there's no police power, right? And it's hard for me to imagine some combination of the Commander-in-Chief Clause and the sort of emergency powers reaching down to the granular level of kind of regulating in a very coercive way the behavior of individuals, even in a crisis. Do you think the deference to executive power and to emergency powers would sort of overwhelm that general sense that the president doesn't have, or that the federal government, you know, enumerated powers actually means some limits on federal power?
You know, I don't know, Ben, because again, we've never had the case. And, you know, I think there are at least two of the five justices in the current, you know, conservative majority who I think would be perfectly happy to subserviate or subserve their sort of federalism principles to their sort of government power and emergency principles. But I don't think we're ever going to get there. I mean, I think this is a point that, you know, when you look back at any kind of, you know, disasters in American history, be they man-made or natural, it was invariably politics that kept us from reaching the, you know, the cliff of the government's legal authorities far more than it was the courts. You know, it was politics that stopped President Bush from activating the military and sending it into Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina, not concerns about, you know, the constitutional limits of the Insurrection Act. So, you know, I think that would be a close case. It would be a messy case. All I would say is that, you know, I doubt we're ever going to get quite that far, but, you know, contrast that, say, with a interstate travel ban where, you know, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, acting in concert with the director of CDC, you know, promulgates a rule that to suppress the spread of the virus, all non-essential interstate travel is prohibited. I actually think that would be constitutional under the Interstate Commerce Clause. And I actually think there's a plausible reading of the existing statutes that would allow the government in a particularly extreme situation to do just that.
Okay, we're going to get to that, to the what the statutes allow in a moment, but let's stick with the federalism matter for a minute. I want to posit one other reason why I think the federal government is unlikely to be kind of Italy-like aggressive, and that's that it simply doesn't have the manpower to do it, that without state and local, and particularly local police authorities to actually carry out whatever policies you imagine, there actually isn't. I mean, the FBI isn't that big. The military has, you know, a lot of people, but it doesn't have enough people to patrol the streets of every city in the United States. And the only actors that have that kind of manpower are state and local law enforcement. And that actually creates a gravitational pull downward to the lower level of authority. your thoughts. Is that silly?
No, I don't think it's silly at all. I mean, I think the capacity part of the story is a critical one, because this is all, you know, a fascinating academic conversation if there's no meaningful capacity on the ground for the government to actually carry any of this out. The complicating factor for me in this story is the very complicated relationship that this administration has with federalism.
It's a transactional relationship, Steve.
Indeed. And I think if this were a different time in a different place, you know, I think it would be much more obvious to me that the administration's first priority would be, you know, finding out what the governors need and using every federal resource to backstop them. I don't think I'm speaking out of school when I suggest that this administration has governors they like more and governors they like less. And so, you know, my concern is that this is not an administration that thinks that way, even if for, you know, logistical and manpower reasons or for constitutional norm reasons or just for practical reasons it ought to.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. All right, let's talk about separation of powers at the federal level, because we're talking about the president kind of waving his arms and wanting to do stuff.
Or at least wanting to look like he's doing stuff.
And certainly that's the way he behaves. But it isn't actually the way federal law behaves. He has certain inherent authorities by virtue of being president. But there is no inherent authority to manage public health crises or to, you know, deliver ventilators. So you're basically dealing with mostly with delegated powers from Congress. And so I guess the question is, you know, let's not skip over the question, what powers has the Congress delegated to the president that are potentially relevant here? I mean, that's a huge list, but like, what are your big few when you think about what are the powers that the executive branch has to bring to bear on this situation? What are you thinking about?
Well, I mean, I think can I make one point off the top and then hit what I think are the big four. So I think the big point off the top is something you said in your question, and I just want to make sure we drive it home, which is, you know, this is not a conversation about the war powers, where there is a long-running, well-joined, you know, historical debate about the division of power in the Constitution between the president and Congress. This is an area where, from the founding all the way through today, it has just been understood that it's Congress's power to delegate. Now, Congress has delegated most of its power in this space. Congress has delegated enormous public health authorities, as we're going to talk about. Congress has delegated a ton of military authority, as we're going to talk about. But, you know, from a pure separation of powers perspective, most of what this analysis is going to turn on is statutory interpretation and not the messier, you know, what can the president do as purely as a matter of Article 2. And I think that's, you know, it's important not to lose sight of that, because it underscores how much Congress not only sort of carries the big stick, but how Congress actually could, if it really thought the president was running awry, you know, could theoretically amass veto-proof supermajorities of both houses and pare back these authorities. So to me, I mean, you know, other people are going to have other examples, but when I think about the government's powers in this field, I think the four most important statutes are the Stafford Act, which, you know, I think folks are most used to hearing about in the context of like hurricane relief and hurricane recovery, which is basically just a broad grant of authority to the president if he declares something called a major disaster or a national emergency to transfer huge sums of money from other agencies and from other purposes and basically sort of throw money at the disaster. And so the Stafford Act is a big part of the funding piece of this. The statute that I think is most squarely on point, but also I think least well known, even to folks who study these issues, is a statute called the Public Health Service Act, which dates to 1944, although it actually has some sort of derivative all the way back to right after the Civil War. The Public Health Service Act is where just about all of the government's public health authorities come from. It's where the CDC's authority comes from. It's where the Surgeon General's authority comes from. We'll talk a bit about sort of the quarantine authority it provides. In the news, you know, on Wednesday was the Defense Production Act, This is a Korean War era statute that basically authorizes the president to do a couple of different things with regard to production of materials that are necessary for national defense. So in this context, think, you know, respirators, think N95 masks, think tests, etc. The sort of the weaker part of the statute gives the president the power to basically let the military cut in line and let the federal government cut in line to buy goods. The much stronger part of the statute, the real teeth of the statute, is actually the federal government directly compelling private companies to produce goods for the government. And then the sort of the fourth is the real elephant in the room. And the fourth is the Insurrection Act, which is the, you know, very, very old source of the government's authority to use military force during domestic crises. And I think that's the, you know, that's the sort of, I don't want to say it's the nightmare scenario, but that is sort of the, you know, the real worst case scenario for how far the government's authority goes when you actually have the military in the streets doing law enforcement.
Right. So I want to, let's talk about that one last. I want to mention one other bunch of authorities, which are the immigration laws, sure, which give the president a lot of authority to do take the steps he's already taken with respect to cutting off entry from particular countries or regions, and also imposing all kinds of new checks on people coming in. Could he do more with that group of statutes than he's already done, other than adding new countries to the list?
He absolutely could. And if I can cheat a little, most of the power that the president has over immigration in this context actually comes from the Public Health Service Act. So, you know, one of the interesting things that the Public Health Service Act does is it creates quarantine authority that is then broken out differentially between what the regulations call interstate quarantines and what the regulations call foreign quarantines. And so this is actually a place where basically HHS and I guess what's now Citizenship and Immigration Services and Customs and Border Protection, their authorities actually overlap rather substantially.
All right. So, you know, earlier in the Trump administration, people like you and I were waxing indignant at his use of emergency powers and the ability to declare a national emergency in order to circumvent Congress's refusal to fund his wall building project. I'm curious whether you think that any of the exercises of these authorities so far, do they trouble you, or do they seem like a reasonable exercise of executive authority in the face of a genuine national emergency?
So at the risk of pissing off everybody, the short answer is they trouble me only because they haven't come fast enough.
In other words, I completely agree with that. I mean, your problem, just to be clear, is not that the president invoked a national emergency and has exercised these potentially sweeping powers that in certain circumstances we find troubling, but that in this case, which is the sort of thing that they were designed for, he was dilatory in doing so. Is it, you don't see any abuse of executive power here. You see negligence of executive power. Is that fair?
Not only is that fair, Ben, but I actually think it ties together to what I think is probably the most important point that I could probably make in this conversation, which is the president's dilatory use of the powers he has, I think is going to end up requiring him to use a lot more of that power in ways that are a lot more controversial and a lot more coercive and a lot more inconsistent.
Give us examples of that. How is it that if you had used these powers earlier, you might be able to use them less?
Sure. So let's talk about the timing, right? So Secretary Azar declared a public health emergency, which is not the same thing as a national emergency, on January 31st. And for legal purposes, what that did was that triggered a small number of public health statutes and a small number of sort of bureaucratic and administrative softening of rules that would have allowed the government, among other things, to ratchet up, for example, experimental drug approval through the FDA, to reallocate at least certain funding resources It would have allowed the government, I think, on a plausible reading of the statute, to dramatically ramp up the production of tests for the coronavirus. And so, you know, I think just the secretary's declaration of a public health emergency actually triggered a bunch of powers that the executive branch, at least so far as we know, Ben, did not aggressively utilize, at least at first. And indeed, 6 weeks elapse between when Secretary Azar declares a public health emergency and March 13th, last week, when President Trump finally declares a national emergency. And even then, the national emergency declaration principally only sort of opens up the spigot for more money. You still have to use it. So, you know, here's my concern. Let's play this forward. Imagine we get to a point where the virus is so widespread in the United States that the only way to relax any of these social distancing measures and the only way to reopen schools and the only way to allow for large-scale gatherings again is if you're relatively confident that the people who are going to these gatherings are not infected. And we have some experience from Italy that shows that you can actually really do that. There was a story online earlier this week about one city in Italy that had an aggressive testing regime and that had really been able to relax some of its measures. If we had massive testing capabilities today, if we were able to provide tests for anyone who was remotely symptomatic or at least anyone who thought they might have been exposed to it, it might be possible for local, state, and federal government officers to target those who are a risk and to pursue suppression measures that are not directed at the entire population, but rather at those who have tested positive if we had better information. The problem is that without that kind of retail information, the government's choices are to do nothing or to take wholesale measures. Wholesale measures like shelter in place, wholesale measures like a mandatory curfew, wholesale measures like an interstate travel ban. We'll never know, Ben, if we had had, you know, much more testing capacity much earlier, if we would have been able to, you know, do all of this on a retail basis. I think the point is that we're not able to do it now. And so the government's limited to these wholesale and, I think, increasingly unpopular responses.
All right. So there are two broad subjects that I want to cover with all of that as preview. One is, what could you do with the military? This is the biggest workforce that the government has that can go in places and do things, right? It can do them fast. It's really good at doing things like building field hospitals. It's also something that we're pretty suspicious of deployments of domestically. The other subject I want to talk about is elections. We have to have an election while we're doing all this. And there's been a lot of anxiety about the way the government could behave in relation to the election. And frankly, you know, there's some basis for concern about that when you look at what happened in Ohio, although I'm not convinced that what Governor DeWine did in Ohio wasn't justified. It certainly poses a democratic problem, let's put it that way. So let's start with the military. You know, if you're Donald Trump and you like grand gestures and you want to be seen to be doing things that look decisive, rolling in the troops is got to be an attractive option, right? And so I guess let's start with, what could you and couldn't you use the military to do with how much ease or difficulty under current law in your judgment?
Sure. I mean, this is, I made the mistake of writing about this in my student note in law school and, you know, being very happy it would never come up. That didn't work out so well.
Yeah, that's the thing about hypotheticals.
Yeah, they you know, they, one day to come true. So let me sort of try to unpack this in a way that will be hopefully useful if a bit long-winded. So I think a lot of folks, you know, who come to this issue either for the first time or as, you know, relative newbies, you know, either know by name or at least understand by insinuation the tradition in this country of not having the military do domestic law enforcement. And that tradition is actually not a founding era tradition. Rather, at the founding, it was pretty routine to have the military, at least in the form of the state militias, provide support for civilian law enforcement because there just wasn't that much civilian law enforcement. Rather, it is a post-Civil War innovation that has somewhat sordid origins. I mean, it was largely a response to the federal military's suppression of racial violence in the not-yet-reconstructed South. But the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 is a statute I think a lot of folks are at least superficially familiar with, and it actually makes it a crime to use the Army or, as amended, the Air Force to perform ordinary domestic law enforcement. The statute has been interpreted by the Department of Defense to include the Navy as well, even though it's not in the text of the statute. And so the basic rule is, unless there's some other statute that authorizes law enforcement operations by the military on U.S. soil, such operations are prohibited. That's why we're used to seeing the military on U.S. soil in a support capacity, that is to say, logistical support to law enforcement, support to FEMA in, you know, building shelters after a hurricane, you know, sort of those kinds of non-direct enforcement capacities are the sort of bread and butter of the military's role in domestic response. And by the military, we should say, you know, here I'm including both the National Guard and what we might call the regular troops. The active duty and reserve service members of the U.S. Army and Navy and Marine Corps, et cetera. But the Posse Comitatus Act is not a constitutional rule. It is only a statutory rule, and it can be overcome by other statutes. It's basically a clear statement rule that Congress has to be clear when it means for the military to be able to do domestic law enforcement. And the statute I mentioned, you know, a bit earlier, by far, I think, the most important statute that satisfies the Posse Comitatus Act is the Insurrection Act. The Insurrection Act is the name that we give today to actually a series of statutes that date all the way back to just after the founding. 1792 was the first one, through which Congress has delegated remarkably broad power to the president to call out first the militia, but then the regular army in three circumstances: to suppress insurrections, to repel invasions, or, quote, to execute the laws of the Union, unquote. And the Insurrection Act is basically the hook for the president to call out the military when laws are not being enforced adequately by the civilian authorities on the ground in a particular jurisdiction.
Yeah, so let me just pause there, because you have a basic conflict between the two laws the two major set of statutes that you've described. On the one hand, you have Posse Comitatus that says you can't use the military for civilian law enforcement without a clear statement from Congress. And on the other hand, you have the Insurrection Act, which has this broad, clear statement anytime the president says that civilian law enforcement isn't adequately enforcing the law, he's entitled to use the military. So I guess the initial question is, absent a bad guy and like some insurrectionist or some terrorist group or some, you know, invader, can the Insurrection Act reasonably be read to swallow whole Posse Comitatus?
I think it depends on the circumstances. I mean, so I think, you know, it is not a massive leap to think that a, you know, natural disaster, right? Nothing man-made, nothing warlike, nothing like that could so overwhelm local authorities as to justify a deployment of federal troops. I mean, I think, you know, after Katrina, I'm one of those who believes President Bush would have been well within his legal rights to send the army into Louisiana and to do it not just to support Louisiana authorities, but actually in areas where, you know, local law enforcement was just not up to the task, to actually, you know, supplant civilian law enforcement or at least supplement civilian law enforcement. So, you know, I think the short answer is the statute as it's written today, and I think the statute as it's been understood for almost all of its history, does not depend upon some underlying act of violence. Rather, it depends upon any set of circumstances where civilian authorities are just overwhelmed. And, you know, the critical reason why we haven't really seen that envelope pushed is because, as much as any other statute on the books, the political constraints on invoking the Insurrection Act have become enormously powerful. So much so that not even President Trump did it with regard to the border, even though that idea had been floated at some point. So, you know, I think part of what's going on here is a very, very broad statute where, at least historically, political norms prevented presidents from abusing it. And we should just say, I mean, we are currently in the longest period in all of American history without an Insurrection Act declaration, without a, you know, domestic deployment of the military for law enforcement. The last time it happened was when George H.W. Bush sent troops into Los Angeles after the Rodney King riots.
Isn't the other factor here that I think would inhibit it, to go back to this earlier point we were talking about manpower, is that it's not entirely clear what U.S. troops could do in a law enforcement capacity that local law enforcement in these communities can't do. If you have a problem of noncompliance with shelter-in-place orders in San Francisco or Berkeley, you know, the San Francisco Police Department or the Health Commissioner's Office is perfectly capable of enforcing that, unless you had kind of mass defiance of it. And, you know, you send in the troops to engage in law enforcement activity, unless you're going to declare martial law, it doesn't substantively change the rules, right?
That's right. I mean, so you know, the activating the Insurrection Act does not change any of the substantive law governing, you know, law enforcement. The troops are supposed to be enforcing the same laws that the civilian law enforcement authorities are enforcing. I think I mostly agree with you, Ben, about why we haven't seen it yet, although, you know, we're still, I think, unfortunately, in the early stages of this crisis. But, you know, short of sending in the military to enforce local shelter-in-place rules, which, by the way, I don't even think would be authorized. It has to be federal law that's not being, you know, properly enforced by civilian authorities. I think the one place where I do, where I can and would see, you know, a potentially lawful invocation of the Insurrection Act would be if the president really does promulgate an interstate travel ban and you want to park, you know, federal troops and National Guard troops along the major, you know, junctions at state borders. You know, I think that sounds like a sort of a scene from a, you know, dystopic apocalyptic fiction movie. But I think, you know, if we really aren't successful, if the current round of measures don't do enough to, you know, abate the spread of the virus, I could see a logical argument that, you know, were it made from any president other than Trump, I think would be a lot easier to swallow, that not only was an interstate travel ban necessary, but that we needed the military to make it effective.
All right. So just walk us through that. What would the legal basis of an interstate travel ban look like in interaction with the invocation of the Insurrection Act to enforce it?
Right. So now we have to sort of get into a little bit of nerdy detail about the Public Health Service Act. So the most aggressive authorities that the federal government has to respond to a public health crisis are authorities that come from a random provision of the Public Health Service Act. Depending upon who you ask, it's either Section 361, because that was the section number of the original statute, or it's 42 U.S. Code Section 264. And what's remarkable is if you look at 42 U.S.C. 264, it actually just delegates a ton of authority to the Surgeon General, to the head of the CDC, to the relevant federal officers, to the Secretary of HHS, to promulgate regulations to deal with the spread of communicable diseases. And so then you have to go to the regulations. And so now we're into the Code of Federal Regulations. This is Title 42, Part 70. Of the CFR, and it's section 70.6, for example, that talks about the rules for the apprehension, medical examination, quarantine, isolation, or conditional release of any individual for the purpose of preventing the introduction, transmission, and spread of quarantinable communicable diseases. And then it's, I think, section 70.14 that puts teeth into federal quarantine orders that basically says, here's how, you know, the director of the CDC can impose some kind of nationwide quarantine. So imagine if we get to a point where the government determines that it is no longer plausible or possible to isolate say even entire cities, let alone individuals within cities, and that the most important thing to do is basically to shut down as much travel as possible. You know, for some of the reasons we discussed earlier, it's going to be hard for the federal government to stop intrastate travel. It's not clear it would be within their constitutional authority. But I don't know that it's that much of a stretch to read, you know, Section 70.6 as basically saying, if the director of the CDC determines that it's necessary to prevent the spread of coronavirus, to stop people from traveling, basically to quarantine every state unto itself, you know, it would certainly be challenged in court. Those challenges would not be frivolous, but it just, you know, I think there would be a pretty powerful argument if we're at a point where, you know, less restrictive measures have been unsuccessful.
And just to tie this part of the conversation to the previous part, the link to the Insurrection Act would be that having determined to do that, that that is necessary, the president could then turn around and say, and federal law, i.e. this quarantine under these regs, is not being adequately enforced by civilian authorities in the face of this emergency situation, and therefore I can call out the military to enforce it. Is that
exactly
the sequence?
Yep, that's exactly right. That the regulations and therefore the Public Health Service Act itself are not being adequately enforced by local and state authorities. And so in order to ensure that these lawful orders promulgated by the director of the CDC acting under authority delegated to him by Congress are enforced, I'm using the military. And I should say, I mean, it's worth noting, you know, the statute and the regulations put teeth into these orders where, you know, there can be criminal consequences. Section 70.18, if folks, you know, want to go check this out, persons in violation of this part are subject to a fine of no more than $100,000 if the violation doesn't result in death, or 1 year in jail, or both. So this is a criminal, you know, the regulation already has criminal teeth. I don't think it would be a stretch if we assume that the ban itself were lawful for the president to say, and because I can't count on the states to enforce this ban, I'm sending in the troops.
All right. So now let's talk about the election.
Right. Now that I've terrified everybody, let's talk about it even more.
So here are the following are all facts. One, several states, in fact, did postpone their primary elections because of coronavirus fears. And those were almost certainly responsible things for those states to do, given the proximity it takes to human proximity it takes for people to vote. Number two, in one state, Ohio, the governor did it as a matter of unilateral executive authority in the face of a court order without legislative support, although the state Supreme Court later backed him on it. But it was a quite aggressive move on the part of the governor. Three, the president has repeatedly suggested, I don't think seriously, but he has repeatedly suggested that maybe he should just be made president indefinitely. And he has also cast doubt on the legitimacy of any electoral defeat, both before he was elected, when people believed, including him, I suspect, that he was going to lose, and more recently. So under those circumstances, it is not crazy for people to be asking the question, what could a president with all these sweeping powers do to interfere in an election that he doesn't believe he might win? And so I guess the question is just that. If you were a president who wanted to not lose an election, and you saw an election coming that you thought you might lose, and you were unscrupulous and had a panoply of powers available that we've just been talking about, what's the best path to mischief? You can't change the election date, can you?
Not by yourself. So I think we have to sort of start with one critical point that I think sort of pushes the rest of this analysis, which is it is the Constitution itself, or at the very least, Section 1 of the 20th Amendment to the Constitution, that decrees that the president's term is over at noon on January 20th, 2021, unless he's been reelected. And so in the absence of an election between, you know, November 3rd, which is the congressionally set election day this year, and January 20th, the president would have no possible claim that he's still the president. Instead, we'd be left to the messy debate about the Presidential Succession Act of 1947, where we'd be left either with the new Speaker of the House, if there is one, or worst case scenario, the President Pro Tem of the Senate. And, you know, just to sort of make things even more ridiculous here, if you look at which Senate seats are up in 2020, if there's no election between November and January, my reading of the math is that Chuck Schumer would be the President Pro Tem of the Senate. So, you know, I don't think even a conspiracy theorist could find a way where without an election, President Trump can still be president come January 20th. But if you know, the conspiracy theory to me is not canceling the election, it's messing with it. It is, you know, making it much harder for people to vote on November 3rd. And so the question I think is, you know, if you're really trying to be malicious, you wouldn't try anything as overt as rescheduling the election. You would try something much more, I think, obnoxious, like just, you know, if we're still in social distancing and, you know, isolation mode come November, making it much, much, much harder for people to actually go to the polls. And so this is where I think, you know, the most important thing Congress and state legislatures, either separately or together, could do between now and November 3rd is provide more facilities for remote participation in the election, basically vote by mail, because that would be the easiest and most obvious way to avoid, you know, that potential for mischief.
And Congress can't really do that except by providing funds for states to do it themselves, right? I mean, it really is state balloting beyond equal protection concerns is genuinely is a matter of state competence, right?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the Constitution is very interesting when it comes to Congress's power over federal elections. I think there's actually a pretty good argument, Ben, and now we're getting a little bit more sort of out of my bailiwick, so let me just sort of summarize my understanding of the debate and then not try to say more. There's a pretty good argument that Congress actually has a lot more power over federal elections than it has historically exercised, and that the Elections Clause of Article 1 would give Congress the power, among other things, to set some kind of national uniform requirement for access to the polls, especially during a public health emergency. But, you know, that would raise its own set of novel questions that would have to be challenged in court, and this is why I think you're seeing a lot of pressure on those states that have historically been resistant to absentee voting in general, to no-fault absentee voting, to really try to at least relax those rules for this fall, if not on a permanent basis.
All right. One more subject before I let you go, which is it's an odd thing for you and I to have a conversation about very aggressive use of executive power and not talk about the challenges to those uses. And I don't want to leave listeners with the impression that if any of these most aggressive scenarios were attempted, that there wouldn't be significant legal challenges to it. So without going into spinning out detailed hypotheticals of each situation, what would you suggest are the major bases on which challenges would develop?
So I think there are three major bases, and I think we can probably put them into three categories in broad terms. And again, let me be clear, here we're talking about challenges to federal exercise of authority. Some of these I think would also be available at the state and local level, some would not. And, you know, for as complicated as the laws at the federal level, you know, multiply that by 50, and we've got sort of the variances in state public health crisis law. So I think the most obvious and sort of, I think, least constitutionally weighted challenge would simply be that the relevant statutes don't authorize the measures the government is taking. And so these would be basically sort of ultra-virus arguments that things like an interstate travel ban or other more coercive measures from the federal government actually exceed the authority that Congress delegated through 42 U.S.C. 264, Section 361 of the Public Health Service Act. You know, those arguments will be attractive to some judges because it would allow them to avoid nasty constitutional questions. The flip side is that, you know, those authorities have historically been read quite capaciously. And so I think, you know, a lot would rise and fall at the federal level on those arguments. Assuming the government stays within its, you know, statutory lines, then we get to the constitutional objections. And I think there are four especially big ones. The first and most obvious is procedural due process, basically that, you know, if the government is imposing these restrictions on people and on their liberty without providing them a meaningful opportunity to contest the restriction, obviously that could raise serious Fifth Amendment due process concerns. And here, Ben, I think we go back to why, you know, the sort of lack of aggressive use of executive power in the 6 weeks after January 31st might actually, you know, lead to more aggressive uses down the line, because I think it's going to be harder for the government to adopt policies that don't have high risk of error. It just might be that that's inevitable. That sort of bleeds into a substantive due process objection. You know, whatever else we might say about substantive due process, it's the idea that, you know, the government has to have a sufficiently good reason for doing the thing that it's doing in this context. And that the sort of the justification has to be well tailored to the actual policy. Here again, I think, you know, a lot's going to depend upon what the actual thing being challenged is and whether there really are less restrictive alternatives available. I think the government's going to be in the awkward position of arguing that, you know, it has to do these wholesale measures because it wasn't, you know, fully prepared for what came. There's, of course, always the Fourth Amendment objections that if the government is conducting any kind of searches and seizures, if there are, for example, you know, checkpoints before you enter or leave particular jurisdictions, you know, I think folks will bring Fourth Amendment challenges. There we'll run into something called the special needs doctrine in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, which is the idea that the government does not need to satisfy the warrant clause of the Fourth Amendment, doesn't need probable cause, or even in some cases, reasonable suspicion, if what it's doing is the vindication of some broader public need that's unrelated to criminal law enforcement. I don't think it's a stretch to see how a quarantine would blend into the special needs doctrine actually quite easily. And last but not least, the weirdest of these is perhaps the right that's most directly on point, which is the right to travel. You know, the Supreme Court has said on multiple occasions, I think most recently in Sines versus Roe in the late 90s, that the Constitution does protect at least some right to travel among and within the United States. But the court hasn't had a lot of opportunities to really put meat on that bone. And so I think, you know, we would see, you know, obviously litigation challenging that. I mean, I'm reminded, Ben, I don't know how many folks have read the Tom Clancy, Jack Ryan book, Executive Orders, but there's a whole sort of plot element in that book about a national travel ban, an interstate travel ban, and the vice president, the former sort of ish vice president, you know, challenging it in court. That's kind of where this might end up, and sort of fighting on the right to travel.
I mean, and I also think it's important to say in reference to the right of travel that the right to travel arguments and the procedural due process arguments would hybridize to some degree.
And the substantive due process arguments, I think, too.
Yeah, but I'm thinking particularly about somebody making the argument, hey, I am not a carrier of the coronavirus, and right, I am willing to subject myself to, I have been tested, and I would be willing to subject myself to any test. And so you are without adequate process to establish that the restriction on my right to travel is necessary, nonetheless restricting my right to travel. And it would, I think it would present as a sort of blended argument of the substantive right to travel combined with the procedural due process. If you want to restrict my right to travel, you've got to give me some process to determine whether it's necessary.
I think that's right, but then I think the government's counter argument would be, we're not in a position to provide individualized process. And so this is why I think, you know, all roads lead back to the inadequacies of our testing regime, right? And the government's inability to engage in that kind of sort of, you know, ground level, case by case, neighborhood by neighborhood, cluster by cluster suppression of the virus. And so that, you know, that's why I think those arguments would be available, but I'm not, you know, I wouldn't have a lot of confidence in them succeeding. And I should say, just before I forget, and just before the, you know, the property rights folks scream at me, there's also the specter of the government taking property and of, you know, the potential takings claims that would arise from that, especially if the government needs to, for example, I don't know, convert hotels into hospitals or things like that. But, you know, in that context, the litigation would only be if the government didn't provide just compensation. So that would be sort of a second order, you know, round of litigation if we get that far.
So, Steve, how does this end? Are we looking at, is this a situation where the testing ramps up over the next few days? We find out, as we are finding out, that there are a really large number of these cases, but with good testing, we actually get surveillance on the situation, and the thing, we've all done our part, the curve flattens, and all these kind of nightmare authorities don't come to pass? Or are you actually contemplating that some of the more aggressive scenarios that we've been describing are more than hypotheticals at this point?
Well, I mean, I should say something I probably should say at the top, which is, you know, I'm not an epidemiologist. And I do think that, you know, too many of us lawyers have been playing epidemiologists on Twitter over the last couple of weeks. So, you know, some of that is really a question of epidemiology. Let me sort of take the legal part. I think that so long as, even if testing improves, and by testing I mean both diagnostic testing and surveillance testing, even if we get to a point where tests are widely available and accessible, and we're able to identify, you know, the full contours of the problem, you know, my understanding of the medicine, amateurish though it may be, is that the virus is going to be a problem until and unless there's widespread access to vaccines. Because, you know, even if there are folks who just for some reason are resistant to the virus or are inoculated from it naturally or have had the virus and no longer can get it a second time, and we're not even sure if that's true, that the virus is going to be present in our society, you know, up until the moment that there's mass scale inoculation or vaccination. And so I think, you know, the question is going to be, how long does it take to get to the vaccination point of this conversation, and how much interference with everyday life will Americans tolerate? Will the government pursue? And will, you know, the sort of the political majority abide between now and then? I hate to be sort of, I'm not usually a pessimist. I'm usually an optimist, but I really think this is going to get a heck of a lot worse before it gets better, and that at least some of these authorities are absolutely going to be brought to bear, with the sort of the sad, tragic irony being, you know, especially coming from someone like me who is not a big fan of executive power, that the ultimate central mistake the Trump administration made was not going to these powers and authorities sooner.
There you have it. The coronavirus has gotten Steve Vladeck to accuse the Trump administration of being wusses on executive power. Steve, thanks so much for joining us. The transformation of us all never ends.
I mean, you know, the one thing I'll say in closing is I think, you know, this is a real emergency. And hopefully it shows both why we ought to be very, very mindful of presidents who cry wolf when it comes to emergencies. Because when the real emergency comes, you know, we want them there at the first sign as opposed to, you know, reacting for political reasons.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. It is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. This week, our audio engineer was me and Steve Vladeck, who recorded ourselves in our respective homes. Special thanks to Steve's dog for her guest appearance on the podcast. You know, recording from home creates all kinds of new variables. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan. You should share the Lawfare Podcast on social media because people need to know that these conversations are taking place. You should review and rate the Lawfare Podcast on whatever podcast distribution service you use. And in these troubled times, you should deck yourself out in Lawfare swag available at thelawfarestore.com. And as always, thanks for listening.